Okay, thank you very much for the invitation. So the invitation, as Graciela already explained, was for a debate. And at first I thought, well, this must be easy debating a woman because based on the recent presidential debates, all I have to do is call her nasty woman and declare a victory. But then they pulled a fast one on me. They said, no, you actually have to debate the issues. But they didn't specify, and that messed up my calculations. But they didn't specify what issues to debate. And then, in a striking parallel with the most recent presidential campaigns, Celine had trouble with her email server. So she moved from the UK to Sydney and stopped checking her email. So we tried to contact her and find out what she's going to say and, you know, what am I supposed to debate. But she wouldn't respond. So instead of a debate, this is going to be a concession speech. I will just I think a good concession speech is better than a poorly constructed debate. Okay. What's that? Well, we'll talk about. There was no collusion. There was no collusion. All right. So. Set the stage and to be, you know, provocative and controversial. So we do believe that dark matter is made of particles, and that's what I'll talk about most of the time. But I'm very interested in what Eric has to say about a modified gravity theory that would hopefully explain all these observations. Now, this is a very exciting possibility because dark matter can just be, you know, one particle that got mixed with neutrinos and, you know, who cares, right? But modified gravity is a very significant advance in our understanding of the world. However, I have a suggestion here, okay? So perhaps we should look at all the data with the exception of the rotation curves, right? Because the case for dark matter can be made on a, you know, large volume of data without ever mentioning rotation curves. And this is a good test bed for any modified gravity. So what we need to explain is the density perturbations and their manifestations in the cosmic microwave background. Basically, you know, this first peak and this second peak tell you about the ratio between all matter and dark matter, right? The first peak is stuff falling into the gravitational potential well, and it depends on all gravitating matter. And the second peak is where the dark matter and ordinary matter are out of phase, right? So this is the stuff that already fell in earlier on, and now it's bouncing back. And the bouncing part has to do with the photon pressure. So this peak knows about the matter that feels photon pressure. Right? And so if you just look at these two peaks, you can get the ratio of dark matter to ordinary matter, and this is what we're trying to explain. Okay? We're also trying to explain gravitational lensing by structures, and this is where we just see the amount of mass that deflects light, assuming that light follows general relativity, but if there is any modification of gravity, again, this needs to explain the data for gravitational lensing. We need to understand how dark matter and visible matter get separated in the merger of clusters. This is an important piece of data. And we need to understand why hot gas can sit in these potential wells created by matter. So this, again, gives us measurement of dark matter content or matter content of these structures, right? So these are the data. And yes, in addition, we'll have the rotation curves. But somehow, you know, the focus on rotation curves distracts from the wealth of data that needs to be explained. Okay? So now, in addition to the wealth of data, we have a wealth of theories. And this artwork is by Tim Tate, who is somewhere here. And I feel very fortunate to play a role of a muse for this artwork because we were writing a report, you know, for the snow mass study, And we needed a picture like this, and I was nudging Tim to do something like this, and he reluctantly agreed. And now this is probably his most famous artwork. What's that?
That's
right. And I won't steal your joke. Right. All right. So there is a plethora of possibilities, and this is both a blessing and a curse, because on the one hand, theorists have a lot to understand, and experimentalists have a lot to detect. But on the other hand, it's hard to get focused on something specific. And people have been using the lamppost approach for dark matter, which is the only approach that makes sense, right? You are supposed to look where you can find something. If you can't find anything, then why look there, right? So this is a very sensible and the approach that explains why WIMPs, for example, gained such prominence, because there were some theoretical motivations in favor of WIMPs. There was a convolution of different experimental techniques that could be used to search for them, from colliders to direct detection to indirect detection, and all of this created a great excitement. However, that doesn't make WIMP the right candidate. It just makes the WIMP a candidate that is well motivated and is relatively easy to search. But there are other non-WIMP candidates. There are many non-WIMP candidates. And in fact, saying non-WIMP, it's not my joke. Someone joked that saying non-WIMP is like non-dog animal, right? And so this is my wife. She loves dogs, but she also loves that dolphin that came to her and let her touch her. And these manta rays and other animals, right? So non-dog animals is a very, very broad variety. And how do you go after them? So I will mention just a couple of non-dog animals that I have encountered, and I will argue that they're well motivated. And one example is sterile neutrinos. We know that ordinary neutrinos have masses, and the usual way to introduce neutrino masses is to write down this Cecil Lagrangian, which couples the left-handed and right-handed neutrinos, and then gives the right-handed neutrinos a Majorana mass. So in doing so, people introduce new particles, new states, namely the right-handed neutrinos. And of course, for dark matter, we're looking for a new particle or a new state. So it's reasonable to ask whether one of these additional new states can be the dark matter particle. In the simplest scenario for production and the relic density, if one of these masses is a KeV, then the admixture that contains a certain amount of left-handed neutrino and certain amount of right-handed neutrinos will have the right relic density for KeV-ish mass. Okay? Now, there are many other ways to produce sterile neutrinos in the early universe, and this is called Dodelson-Widrow scenario, and it comes from just oscillations of active neutrinos into sterile neutrinos. And this occurs at a temperature of about 100 MeV, and this process is sort of generic and cannot be turned off. But if you produced a population of sterile neutrinos early on from decays of heavy particles, singlet Higgs boson can decay into sterile neutrinos, etc., then you will have an additional population. And that additional population will have different kinetic properties. So this dark matter is on the warmer side. It has non-zero free streaming lengths. But if you produced an earlier batch of sterile neutrinos, they will be colder because their momentum will be redshifted. So there is a motivation for considering sterile neutrinos. There is a variety of models. I didn't even list them here, how to produce them in the early universe. You can have a single component or multiple component of dark matter in the form of the same particles, because they can be produced at different times, and they can have different kinetic properties and different clustering properties. So the structure formation is rich and presents many possibilities, but all of this produces a very nice experimental signature, namely a narrow spectral line with the energy, which is mass of sterile neutrino over 2. And that is because the sterile neutrino can decay into an active neutrino and a gamma ray, and an X-ray photon. And from a completely different motivation comes some other possible dark matter that would have the same signature. For example, Neil Wiener introduced exciting dark matter, which has a way of producing narrow KV spectral line. And if you try to solve supersymmetry string moduli problem by turning these scalar particles into dark matter, then you also end up with something that can produce that signature, because these guys can decay into two photons. Not a photon and a neutrino, but two photons. But the end result is the same. You're looking for a narrow spectral line. So the searches have been done extensively. In fact, Mike Lowenstein and I first started these searches long ago. We thought that people used archival data, but no one actually applied for time and got time on X-ray telescopes, because these are, there are just three of them, and the whole astrophysics community is after them. So when we thought, well, the astrophysicists will never, the astronomers will never let us play with their toys and point them to the darkest corner of the universe where they cannot see anything. But we got time on Chandra, XMM, and Suzaku, and produced the first limits with just dedicated observations. And then people went further. And more recently, two groups independently claimed that there was a line at 3.5 keV. You probably can't see it very well. So let me use a you see this here, right? There is a the residuals don't just add up to zero, so there is a little bit of something, and there is also here there's something that looks like residuals deviate from zero, right? And so that was the exciting result that needed for the studies. So if you put this on the plot with various other limits, then the claim detection is around here. Now this is mass, this is the mixing angle of sterile neutrino. I don't bother to put 2 theta here, because these are such small numbers that sine theta is equal theta, and there's no reason to worry about cosine. So this is the allowed parameter space, and if it happens to be here that emission of this particle also explains the asymmetric velocity emission of a neutron star from a supernova, so this explains the pulsar kicks. Here you can't go because of the exclusion by X-rays, and also you don't want too much dark matter. And there are 2 exclusion plots here, right? So I put here both. So this exclusion plot is not assuming any density of dark matter. And this one, and this one assumes that 100% of dark matter is sterile neutrinos. So here, you can have a particle with this mixing and this mass, but it will not be 100% of dark matter, okay? But if you assume that 100% of dark matter, then... And you don't want to go here, because then dark matter is way too warm. So more recently, there was this very exciting but sad story with Hitomi, the X-ray instrument that used cryogenic volumetric arrays for very precise spectroscopy of X-rays. But the sad story is that it was destroyed due to a combination of several human errors, and it only produced very short exposure plot, and the instrument was even covered with the beryllium cap, so there was not much data. But even with that data, this possibility can be excluded in some part of the allowed space. And I forgot to give credit to Keva Bazajian here. That's his plot, so I'll add it to the slides later. So there is still a possibility that signal survives, and that signal may be the great discovery that we're after, or it may not be, right? So in the Sidney Harris cartoon, you know, this could be the greatest discovery of the century, depending on how far it goes. So now I'm going to switch gears to something completely different and discuss some other potential dark matter in the form of primordial black holes. So these are black holes made in the early universe, and for a long time people have considered it a likely candidate for dark matter. What I will mention today is that now we have new and more, in my opinion, much more generic ways to make primordial black holes in the early universe. And we also have some new ways to go after them. So it turns out that you don't need much to make black holes in the early universe. All you need is a scalar field, which is not too massive. Okay? If you have a scalar field with relatively small mass, mass smaller than the Hubble parameter during inflation, then that field doesn't sit in the minimum of the effective potential. Instead, it jumps around. Okay? Now, it jumps around is because energy is not conserved, just like it's not conserved today. You know that energy is not conserved, right? In case somebody misled you to think that there's energy conservation, you can give a counterexample. You can take a chain and attach it to a star on the other side of the universe, and the expansion of the universe will generate energy forever, right? Energy is not conserved. Okay. But now, if somebody, some people may have made the case for energy conservation, but they must have used some mathematical theorem that relied on time translational invariance, which time translational, which symmetry is broken by the expansion of the universe, right? So when the universe is expanding, you don't have that symmetry, you have some other symmetries, but that's a separate issue, right? So in the Sitter universe, energy is not a conserved quantity, and the field can just borrow energy from gravity and jump around. Now, when it jumps from here to here, next step it can jump back, but it will never hit the same target here, right? It will just keep jumping, and you develop a statistical ensemble with very large expectation value. On average, this can be calculated, on average they are of the such that each degree of freedom carries the roughly the Hubble parameter size energy. And then when inflation is over, the scalar field has to come down to the minimum, and there's this well-known instability that the scalar field doesn't roll uniformly in space. It breaks up into large lumps. And then these lumps can evaporate. They can disappear. So who cares? Well, thank you. Okay, so here's, I mean, and this was studied numerically and analytically, right? So what can happen at the end of inflation is that the scalar field falls, forms these lumps. And these lumps scale as matter because they are matter, except they're not made of many particles. They're made only of a few very large particles. And if that matter comes to dominate the universe, then for a limited period of time, you have matter-dominated era with, you know, big lumps, and you don't have zillion particles per horizon. You have matter that has only a few, only a million particles per horizon. So the Poisson fluctuations are large. And then you can just look for places where there is a positive fluctuation and count them. But that's not enough to make black holes. If you have an overdensity here, it's not going to make a black hole unless it's really, really spherically symmetric, because otherwise it will just make a Zeldovich pancake, right? So you take a penalty, you also just count those configurations that are really spherically symmetric. And so all of this is very improbable to make a black hole, right? But it's enough to make enough black holes to be entire dark matter, right? So you look for you know, big clumps instead of small clumps, and we did this with Eric Kottner and Volodymyr Takhistov. And then you end up with the mass distribution function for primordial black holes, which can be 100% of dark matter. This is the ratio of omega to what you need for dark matter in this range where there is a window, and it can also produce a similar shape distribution elsewhere. Let me just mention a few things about the constraints. These are those constraints that I sort of believe in. For example, there have been many attempts to close this window between 10 to the 20 and 10 to the 23 grams, or 10 to the minus 13 minus 10 solar masses. But so far, no one has succeeded. Okay, so for example, a recently published microlensing limit from this very nice instrument, hypersupreme camera on Subaru telescope. They tried to exclude this entire patch, but they ran out of steam at those masses where the Schwarzschild radius becomes smaller than the wavelengths of light. And so at that point, there's no microlensing. The microlensing amplification is strongly suppressed when the event horizon becomes smaller than the wavelengths of light. And to see that, you need to use the wave properties of light. And they originally didn't know that, and so that limit only is valid up to here. There was another attempt to close this window with neutron stars, but turns out that neutron stars can be destroyed by primordial black holes, but not at the rates that you would worry about them. In fact, they would be destroyed at the rates consistent with making heavy elements. The same study, by the way, presents one candidate event. So this is what a microlensing curve would look like if a primordial black hole with 10 to the minus 7 solar mass passed the line of sight. So this passes all the cuts, but who knows? That one little star may do this again. So now they are watching that star to see if it does it again, then this is not a microlensing event. But if it doesn't do this for a while, then maybe this is the start of a detection. Neutron stars can be destroyed by primordial black holes, and in the process, the neutron-rich material can be released, and this can contribute to our process nucleosynthesis. But none of this is happening at the rate that would place a meaningful constraint on primordial black holes just yet. If I don't have any more time, I will stop. If not, I'll go on for another hour. Okay, so I can just stop here. No conclusion slides.
Questions for this lecture, and then we open up our discussion, I hope. So, questions for?
Hi, Alex. Just one technical question. So, on your plots for stereo neutrino dark matter, the regions where you say pulsar kicks are allowed, do I interpret correctly that you would even say that this is preferred?
Okay, so this is a very good question. Thank you. So, yes, we don't know what exactly makes the neutron stars acquire these hundreds of kilometers per second velocities, right? For the last 30 years, the astrophysics community's answer has been that we almost understand it, right? And so the asymmetries in the collapse could explain this, but so far they have not. And the as calculations improve, there's always a hope that just from the asymmetries, you may be able to explain why a neutron star flies out of a supernova with a velocity of several hundred kilometers per second. It's actually easier to explain few hundred kilometers per second, but 15% of pulsars have velocities larger than 1,000 kilometers per second, and that is very difficult to get from supernova explosion. Sterile neutrinos with these masses and mixing angles would, in fact, be emitted asymmetrically from a cooling neutron star and would accelerate it to the required kick velocities. So yes, it would be interesting if this particle lived around here.
So there have been experimental demonstration that 3.5 keV line is caused by the charge exchange of the barium sulfur with atomic hydrogen. In light of that, would you still think that dark matter has a viable explanation?
Thank you very much for this question. So I don't know enough to defend that statement or to refute it. And I will defer this to the experts. I don't know if Kev is here, but he can discuss this. You know, it's a difficult business to separate lines from lines when the energy resolution is only, you know, 100 EV on a kV. And that's what we have always had with Chandra XMM and Suzaku. Now, with the new generation of instruments, with Hitomi and hopefully its replacement that should be flying in a few years, the energy resolution has become much, much smaller and much better. And so now it's much easier to separate lines. So now there's probably be more clarity. If you see a line in the spectrum, you will not confuse it with an atomic line. Moreover, the actual shape of the line can tell you where it's coming from. Because again, with the relatively low energy resolution that we have now, we can't see the shape of the line. But with the Hitomi, with the bolometric array technology, we can see the difference between a line that is broadened by thermal effects or other atomic physics effects versus a line that is broadened by just the motion of particles in the halo. They actually have slightly different shapes, and we will be able to see that. And that will be a very decisive test for any line that comes from decaying dark matter.
Simon Beer, UCLA. A question about the constraints from primordial black holes. There were recently a paper about the magnification distribution of lensed supernovae. Let's say this can put quite strong constraints. So where would this follow in, and do they suffer the same issues with the wavelength that you mentioned?
Right, very good question. Okay, so what you want is the wavelength, so the magnification is significant when the wavelength of light is smaller than the Schwarzschild radius. It's actually, it has nothing to do with the Schwarzschild radius per se. It has to do with the Einstein radius, but, you run out of combinations of the black hole mass and the Newton's constant, right? So it's the same thing that gives you Schwarzschild radius also gives you Einstein radius. So suppression is very strong when the wavelengths of light is greater than the size of the Schwarzschild radius. Therefore, this femtolensing constraint based on gamma rays is very reliable because it's in the regime where the wavelengths are smaller than the Schwarzschild radius, much smaller, right? So if you use gamma rays, you can go to smaller masses, right? If you use visible light, you run out of steam here. So you simply don't have any microlensing happening for masses below 10 to the 22 grams, okay? So if the claim is made that they can go with optical observations into this regime, then they probably have to, include wave effects. If the claim is that they can go there with gamma rays, that is a very interesting possibility. And in fact, if you have any suggestions on how to explore this three order of magnitude gap between the constraints, that would be very valuable.
Yes, just a moment.
You show very restrictive bounds from the X-ray background and spectral distortions of the CMB on, say, 10 solar mass black holes or 30 solar mass. I had the impression that they had been weakened if you account for the fact that the accretion onto the black hole may not be spherically symmetric. In fact, right. It's very unlikely to be so.
Okay, it's a very good point. So for the CMB distortions, you need to understand the accretion very well, and you need to understand what happens to the gas as a result of that accretion, the ambient gas. So there's a lot of, some of these steps have been questioned, and there is uncertainty. For the XRB, I think there is less uncertainty because that bound is based on just the dilute gas accreting onto a black hole. So the black hole passes through gas in our galaxy, right? And you have some X-rays that are emitted from accretion onto the black hole. So that accretion probably is well described by Bondi-Littleton, you know, so that there's probably more understanding of that, okay? But again, anything that has to do with gas is a complicated problem. And yes, there may be room for improvement there.
And or for weakening of that bond.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
Okay, let us thank Alex again for his talk. And now let us start our debate. And I think one idea that I think is useful for all of us to think is what Celine argued. So we are doing plenty of things, and actually if we have, as an example, what happened with neutrinos and neutrino masses and mixings, if dark matter is, if neutrinos happen to be a good example for dark matter, and I think in some way it is, you know, we were looking, and we, I must say we actually, our experimental colleagues that devoted many, many years of their lives looking for mixings and masses of neutrinos where they were not. You remember Dumand and so on, years and years of exploration. And then all of a sudden, you know, an indication of neutrino, well, not all of a sudden, but it came along through solar neutrinos and then using a pool, big pools of water, Super K, Kamiokande initially, and so on and so forth, that were made for something else, to look for proton decay. So we were looking, and then all of a sudden we found something. If you are not looking, you are not finding anything, and that's for sure. So the effort has to be there. So the issue is the following. We are doing many, many things, but are we not doing things that we could be doing and you think would be useful? And are we putting resources in places where we shouldn't instead? Or this is, I think, a very useful issue, right, given all the uncertainties. Do you want to?
Sure. I've got a crazy idea that nobody's ever been able to answer for me. This might be the right audience. So I have an extremely large column density of dark matter through the galactic center and much less in the anti-center. If you looked at the old what was called the owl's eye and fly's eye experiments, there was actually something that you could convince yourself was a shadow toward the galactic center. So my question is, can an ultra-high energy cosmic ray against a pion excite the delta resonance or do something else to actually give you an interaction that would between dark matter and ultra-high energy cosmic rays? There's no feature that I can see in the Auger data now, but you could look for it. You could set a constraint if there was in interaction. So just from the standpoint that you don't find it if you don't look.
In which way you would look?
What?
In which way you would have to look?
Well, so of course, the thing is that, you know, so I hit a photo pion threshold by exciting the delta resonance because the photons are 10^-3 eV, and, you know, that lets me make the delta resonance from something that's high enough energy. If I have an axion that's any more massive than that, and I have a channel, it would be Pierre Auger. You're looking at ultra-high-energy cosmic rays, so you're looking at arrival directions, and you're looking for a shadow against the galactic center, because, like, within about 15 degrees of the galactic center.
This would be a reinterpretation or reanalysis of data.
Well, you'd need a you'd also want a physical effect, but you could even look without a physical effect.
Well, within 15 degrees of the galactic center, you will certainly see something in cosmic rays because there's a lot of going on in the magnetic, you know, magnetic fields in the galactic center probably will show up in other things. Well, right, but the density of dark matter is probably not sufficient considering the constraints on
dark matter interaction.
But this would imply reanalyzing data that we are already getting, right? But the issue is, are we not doing something in the, that we could push as a community that actually would be extremely useful to do?
I just wanted to add, I think there are a bunch of constraints on dark matter cosmic ray interactions based on cooling curves for cosmic rays. Those tend to only exist at really, really high cross-sections for nucleon scattering, because there also is a lot of gas that has a high cross-section with the cosmic rays already. So if you want to look for a probe of, you know, nuclear cross-sections of 10 to the minus 20-something around a barn or something like that, I think that's a way to go. But I think it's a different type of probe for really low interaction dark matter nucleon scattering.
Oh, no, sorry, I was just waiting. Sorry? Oh, I see. Anybody has some other? How far are we going to go with observations, with comparison of a structure formation in terms of determining the properties of dark matter? How far in terms of detecting if it is non-interacting, self-interacting, interacting with some kind of interaction? How far are we going to go? Are there some limitations in this respect?
Graciela, you're looking at me. Yes. Okay, so I guess you want me to answer the question.
Yes.
All right, so I can answer the question. I can answer the question. I think we're going to get very far, but indirectly. And what I think is coming from ASTRO is not a new idea. It's been around for a long time. It's been around since Simona Vigetti did her thesis. And that is, we can, the key prediction of CDM is that there should be many, many, many small halos that are too small to make a galaxy. How do you spot those? Through a particular kind of lensing that I will describe in a minute. And what we will be able to do is count how many of these dark, tiny halos that don't have a galaxy there are around. And what that will distinguish is models like CDM, where the power spectrum continues indefinitely to small scales, from models which may or may not be self-interacting, certainly neutrinos, stellar neutrinos that predict a cutoff in the power spectrum. So the big difference between CDM and what Alex was talking about the 7 keV stellar neutrino, is that CDM has millions, hundreds of millions of small halos, whereas the 7 keV stellar neutrino doesn't. And so the question then is, how do we detect the mass function of invisible halos? Now there's a test that's been around, say, for 10 years or longer, which consists of looking for distortions in Einstein rings that are produced when a light ray, it gets lensed by one of these invisible structures. And those distortions are very well characterized. We understand them very well. They're just very difficult to find because they're very small. But there's actually a surprisingly small community in the world of people trying to do this, which I think is the most fundamental test we can do from astrophysics. But there are people doing it. There are data. So, for example, there's a paper that I was part of with Ran Lee as first author, where we argued that 100 examples of Einstein rings would be enough to rule out CDM for good, or to rule out the alternative. So these are Einstein rings, which is a particular kind of lensing where you have. It doesn't matter where they are. There's a sample already with 100 lenses called the slack sample. They are Richard 0.2. There are other samples with adaptive optics at Richard 0.7. There's all the ALMA interferometric data. So today we have 100 or so lenses. Once Tony's instrument gets going, there'll be thousands, hundreds, tens of thousands of lenses. And that is where I was telling you earlier that you were saying, particle physicists have faith in astrophysicists, astrophysicists have faith in particle physicists. I said, no, we've lost faith in you. So we're taking the law on our own hands. And what we will achieve, I mean, you can never with astrophysics prove that the dark matter is this or that. What you can do, and we saw from Alex's talk, is exclude possibilities. And the exciting thing is now we're on the verge of excluding CDM if it's not the right answer, or excluding any other alternative where the power spectrum has a cutoff at a particular scale. Obviously, if the cutoff is at a very small scale, then you can tell. But if the cutoff is such that at a scale corresponding to about 10 to the 7 solar masses or so, or bigger, those can be excluded. And I think I've been saying this for a long time. We're saying dark matter will be discovered within the next 5 years. So I've been saying for about 20. But this one will happen within 5 years, and if not, just as soon as LSST goes up, then this is an unambiguous test. Finally, we know how to do it.
Go ahead.
This is Alex Derlicka-Wagner from Fermilab, and I strongly agree with that statement. I would just emphasize that lensing, galaxy-galaxy lensing is not the only way to do this, and I think it should be a broader program to try and probe below the threshold of galaxy formation with both local and more distant probes. So gaps in stellar streams, the kind of halometry that I think Neil is going to talk about later. But I think this is generally the frontier, is pushing below the threshold of galaxy formation to try and find dark matter without baryons.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm Simona. I'd like to thank Carlo for giving my talk. Well, I think you're always very optimistic. it's going to be harder, but I'll show some more on Friday. But it's, I think we're a bit further away than what you're saying, maybe.
Yeah. And one thing with, I think, the theory prediction also in the astrophysics really comes in, and we will be overflown or already overflown by data of different scales and our Milky Way in the higher redshift universe. And can we really understand and decouple the astrophysics and the dark matter physics thereof? And I think there it's crucial to combine these probes to get a handle on each individual systematics and prediction, say disruption of halos, etc., that we may not understand to that level that we actually can, you know, rule completely out Lana CDM.
Justin.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. With all the different constraints we have that give us evidence for dark matter, we need exactly this kind of complementarity when we want to push below the scale at which halos form stars. And one very nice complementarity between the stream studies and the lensing is the lensing gives us a snapshot of the substructure in the halo as we see it now, but the streams are actually sensitive to any substructure bombardment over the time at which the stream has lived. So it actually contains some information about substructure interactions backwards in time. And if we can harness that, that might be quite powerful.
Just a clarification. So when we probe with the lensing, we're not just looking at the substructure, we're actually looking at the entire line of sight, and that's the dominant contribution, actually, if you're high redshift, and actually that's a cleaner measurement, and I'll show on Wednesday, because it means we are less dependent on assumptions on what the baryons are doing. So that's why. Julio?
Yeah, I'm Julio Navarro. I'm a new graduate student here, so I'm running the microphone, as you can see. Now, one thing that I wanted to add to the discussion was that if these dark matter halos that are, you know, subluminous, you know, their place are so small they can't host a galaxy, we'll still have to host some baryons. Right? There's still gravitational potential. If you take them away from, say, the environment of the Milky Way, in the middle of basically the field, they should be filled with gas. Right? The gas should be ionized hydrogen, basically, and helium, nothing else, because it hasn't been polluted for stars, because it never formed stars. So, and there should be thousands of them. And unfortunately, they're very heavily ionized, they're very difficult to see, but if we can, you know, devise a way to detect either the traces of H1 that may be at the center, or, you know, some other way of detecting just ionized hydrogen, I think it would be one fundamental way of looking for these things as well. That is different from what has been proposed so far.
These are too small, they don't have any gas.
No, inside the galactic halo, yes, because the lost light is tripping, but if they're in the middle of nowhere, they're full of gas. So.
Yeah,
Just along the lines of like looking towards the future, one thing that I'm particularly excited about is are the faintest galaxies. So like DES has already like sort of in many ways revolutionized this, but looking forward to LSST, I mean, looking at systems that are, you know, at sort of the faintest limits, like a few hundred solar masses, that I think is really the key test bed for me in terms of like measuring differences between different models, whether it's WOM or SIDM or CDM. I don't think the predictions are in place now, but it's very clear that when you get down to, you know, those small systems where you're probing the densities, hopefully on like tens of parsec scales for the dark matter, I think that really is going to be a game changer. And that's where, for example, like, you know, future surveys like LSST is going to be amazing. I mean, we will need to follow these things up. So the big telescopes are really important, but we need to find more of them. It's not going to be one system here, one system there. You won't be able to tell the difference. But with, like, let's say hundreds of these things down the road, I really feel like that is going to nail this. It's going to be very hard to get out of that.
Obviously, dark matter was found through gravitational effects, and we will have to find dark matter through gravitational effects and continue to test it. But don't let us not leave elementary particle physicists off the hook, actually. There are many things that we can do. I mean, our faith, not so much in supersymmetry, at least in my point of view, supersymmetry was like a paradigm for having some physics beyond the electroweak scale, and we were supposed to find heavy particles. That's what we thought, particles that were heavier than 100 GeV, that were the scale, was the scale that we could explore without the LHC. And therefore, those particles that we were going to find as soon as the LHC was able to find something, those would be mediators maybe for new interactions, and those interactions therefore are weak order or a little bit weaker than weak because the intermediary particles of these interactions were heavy, right? So TeV scale or so. This doesn't seem to be actually panning out, but that's not the only possibility, and of course it can still be that actually the LHC will find something. But the other possibility is actually that there are light mediators, or actually that the dark matter interacts extremely weakly. This is the idea of having these windows towards or to right very weakly coupled with neutrinos, very coupled with Wilker, and so on and so forth. So there is a plethora of different ideas, so now people are exploring other ranges of interactions with very new ideas. How many of them will actually be realizable? I'm not sure, Is there a direction in particle physics that we are not exploring at this point that you think would be a promising venue, and maybe we are not pursuing? Because of course this very large and extremely sensitive detectors might reach to the neutrino floor at some point. I guess that there is enough support in the community to continue upgrading and making these experiments larger and more sensitive.
Yeah, I think there may be on that beautiful artwork by Tim Tate on the far upper left border, there are dark photons. That's a possibility. I don't know if Peter Graham is here yet, but they would be created. Oh, he's not coming. Okay. They would be created during inflation, and that could be easily the dark matter. And there are some experiments that some folks are thinking of to start looking for them, magnetically and electrically, because there's some kinetic coupling to Maxwell.
I'm Sam McDermott from Fermilab. I'm actually not registered for this conference. I'm actually participating in the particle physics workshop, which is going on right now. just the high energy physics, the sensitivity frontier of high energy physics. So a lot of these ideas are getting talked about there for new detectors. We're looking for slightly non-standard dark matter particles like the dark photon just mentioned, things that are like axions, but not exactly the QCD axion. There's a lot of different ways to go look for these things. So the particle physicists are on it, and we are trying to think of good, promising directions to go.
Mike Boylan Colchin from the great state of Texas. So I guess to follow up on Celine's point about have we sort of exploited all of the probes that we have, is there anything we can say, how much further down can we press the dark matter photon sort of cross-section or things like that with dedicated experiments? Because that would seem to be an interesting number that we have, you know, an upper limit on now, but it's not, you know, it's not dramatically small. It's only 6 or 7 orders of magnitude lower than sort of dark matter electron scattering, I guess. So what's the prospect for really understanding how dark matter would be?
Thanks. So I think it's all depending on what gravitational lensing is going to achieve. So if we were getting enough information about the very small scales, we can push the limit. So currently we have a limit which is bringing us, which depends on the dark matter mass. So for a particle of MeV, you can reach the weak strength cross-sections, which is very good, I mean, if you think about it. But it's not good enough compared to what other experiments can do. So if you could, with gravitational lensing, if you could have an information about the scales around 10 to the 6 solar masses, you push, I think you already gain at least a factor 10, 100, and then any other information, but at some stage is going to be limited by the fact that you cannot really get a good information below 10 to the 3 solar masses. So it will be limited. But at least it's a different info, I mean, it's data. So it's not just pure speculation and trying to, you know, we have a data, so we should exploit the data.
Graciela, who am I to intrude in the world of particle physics? But it seems to me there's an experiment that I don't understand why it's not being done. And that is this, the most attractive, in my mind, alternative to a WIMP is the 7 keV stellar neutrino. There's already evidence for it. So why are there no experiments looking for stellar neutrinos? So it's Katrina, but it's looking completely in the wrong range of stellar neutrino mass. Then there are experiments that have been proposed. There's this SHIP experiment that Misha Shaposhnikov has proposed. I understand that it's kind of not cheap, but why are the particle physicists not looking harder not from X-ray lines, which are confusing, but why are they not looking harder for a traditional particle physics experiment to find the neutrinos? Yes.
So a quick announcement, hey. We are going to have a very novel experiment at UCLA.
Our AMO people got funded to do the experiment called Hunter, and what they're going to do is trap radioactive cesium atoms in an optical trap, then observe them decay and fully reconstruct the products of decay, including the momentum of the recoiling atom, the gamma, the X-ray, gamma ray, and the electron, right? So this is a very ambitious project, but they are funded and they're moving to build this apparatus.
So you see stellar neutrinos?
So they will be able to, by complete kinematic reconstruction, they hope to see the sterile neutrino mass. And you know, the first prototype that they will build will not go to the mixing angles that we need. It will be an order of 200 orders of magnitude short. But then they will put more atoms into the trap. And you know, they're working with cesium atoms, so they have enough decays to eventually go after the interesting parameters. They are, I think they have to start spending money now. That's right.
Within a year, they will do the preliminary though, but the final, so they are going to demonstrate the idea really, but the final experiment is yet not funded. Okay.
So they have $2 million from Keck Foundation, and that's what will get them to a certain point, and then they need more funding.
the answer is that it is very difficult to do to look for the answer why it is not done. It is done. There is an experiment I don't remember at CERN. There is a I don't remember the name. No, there is an experiment to look for sterile neutrinos interacting, but of course you have to do it through endpoint the measurements. They're difficult measurements.
You will not be looking for sterile. You're going to look for endpoint deviations.
Yeah.
And you know very well that in the past people have actually found as much as 7 sigma evidence for a 17.1 kV deviation.
Yes.
You know, back in 91.
Yes.
So it is not that particular physicists don't look for them.
Yes. No, they are very difficult experiments.
SHIP is not designed to look for KeV sterile neutrinos. It's designed to look for, you know, GeV sterile neutrinos. But
no, but there is an experiment now. I don't remember the name it, in which they are going to look within this range KeV too.
Right, so you see that famous picture of trying to put Katrina through the streets of.
It will be a modification of Katrina. So first they're going after the, you know, standard neutrino, M1, right?
Sure.
So mostly. But.
Dogs.
We don't. No, you don't know enough.
If SHIP finds the GeV sterile neutrino, those baryon asymmetry and all that kind of stuff, so how close are you then from inferring that if the GeV sterile neutrino exists, there must be a KeV? Is that almost inevitable, or can you just have the GeV and no KeV?
I actually don't know of any logical connection that would give you from one to another. Misha
has a logical connection.
Right. So that's right. So the logical argument has to go through Misha.
Yes, there was somebody. So here, how far are we from closing the possibility of having all the dark matter or the bulk of the dark matter being primordial black holes? That can be
right.
Done, I think.
So I don't know how to search in the window of three orders of magnitude between 10 to the 20 and 10 to the 23 grams. So in that window, as far as I know, there are no good ideas how to search for primordial black holes, other than by their effect on neutron stars, which they can destroy and create some population of one solar mass black holes, right? So if you look at astrophysical black holes, you never make one solar mass black holes. But if you have small primordial black holes, they could infect the neutron stars and consume them from the inside, and then the result is one solar mass black hole. So if you see a population of such objects, you would know that something funny is going on, and that small, you know, you would infer that small primordial black holes are likely to exist. But directly probing the mass range between 10 to the 20 and 10 to the 23 grams is very challenging, and I don't know of a good idea.
What about kind of an indirect probe? What would be the sign that things were inhomogeneous at the time of nucleosynthesis?
So primordial black holes with these masses would produce very homogeneous distribution of dark matter, and I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, what I'm saying is if I have inhomogeneities at an early time that can make primordial black holes, then I likely have inhomogeneities at the time a primordial nucleosynthesis. Can I see any signs in early element abundance of that?
Well, if you make primordial black holes by modifying the spectrum of primordial density perturbations, if you play with the inflaton potential, then depending on your model, you may have some additional manifestations of the kind that you mentioned. If you make primordial black holes from just a scalar field that fragmented and came to dominate the energy density of the universe and then decayed, then there's no other signatures on any other length scales.
So I'm not suggesting I have to happen, but what is the first way I would see it?
Well, if you have some deviations from the scale invariant spectrum of density perturbations, you can, depending on the scales, you will discover it in various types of astronomical observations first, and then you would ask questions where they come from, and then you would try to reconstruct the origin of this of these fluctuations. But at the moment, we have actually very good agreement. Well, here's Julio can comment on that.
So at 10 to the minus 23 grams, we're talking about 10 to the minus 10 solar masses, right? So that's just a little less than Pluto. An object moving at that speed of halo speeds would have a kinetic energy comparable to the binding energy of the Earth. So I don't know if anybody's done the calculation of how often such a thing would smack into a planet.
Right, but right. Very good question. So if such an object hit the Earth, it would just go through it, like a bullet from going through a cloud of fog, okay? If it goes through the sun, it also doesn't change the momentum by appreciable amount. So that's why neutron stars are the places where you would look for captures. And even with the neutron star, the first passage, it actually goes through it and then comes back. Okay? So, and the density of dark matter in this form is very small in terms of number density. So there's one of them circling around the solar system.
There's one small window that is still open. And that's between about 6 solar masses and 100 solar masses. And it will be probed by LSST and other experiments. And this is due to black holes in that range. And the reason it's interesting, I think, is because LIGO is finding binary black holes in that range. And so the two ways of probing it are to look at the microlensing of these black holes that are trucking along between us and the center and stars in the center of the galaxy. And also, that number of black holes would disrupt binary stars in the outer parts of our own galaxy, and that's something that can be seen as well.
All right, so let us thank our debaters again. And so we will have coffee and then come back for what will be our second debate of the morning then. Okay. At 11:00.